Rebecca Harker, The Quiet Harbor. Before she was Rebecca Harker, before she became the quiet center of a house overlooking cold water, she had belonged to no one at all. Her parents died within the same hard year. First her mother in late winter, from a fever that settled in the lungs, it would not loosen its hold. Then her father the following autumn, when a wagon overturned on a rutted road outside of town and pinned him beneath its weight. There were no sisters to take her in, no married brother with a spare room, no kindly aunt waiting in the country. There were distant relations, but distant in every sense, and none were eager to assume responsibility for a thin, solemn girl of 14 who had already grown too serious for her age. So Rebecca learned early what many women only discovered after marriage or widowhood, that survival often depended less on strength than on steadiness, of course. The town did not turn its back on her entirely. A churchwoman who knew her mother arranged for her to help with mending for a season. An elderly widow rented her a few narrow rooms on her unused second floor at a reasonable rate. Another lady pressed cast-off dresses into her hands, altered hastily, but neatly enough to pass. It was learning to be grateful without ever becoming secure. By 16, she was old enough to understand that pity was temporary, but usefulness could last. When a position opened at Willett's Marine and Stationery, she was recommended as dependable. The shop stood on a side street not far from the docks, close enough that one could smell the lake when the wind shifted. Its window displayed practical goods rather than luxuries: folded charts, brass compasses, mariner's almanacs, bottles of ink, writing paper, devotional booklets, weather guides, pencils, candle, twine, sealing wax, and oddities of nautical hardware too small or specialized to merit space in the chandlery. The place served captains, clerks, mates, schoolmasters, and the occasional farmer who came in at Christmas time to buy a Bible or a book of sermons for a wife who read aloud by lamplight. Rebecca fit there so naturally that within a few months, even regular customers seemed to assume she had always belonged behind the counter. She learned the inventory quickly. She knew which captains preferred the old British and Canadian charts, and which trusted only the newer American revisions, which men came in to buy what they needed, and which lingered because the shop was warm and well lit and found that she listened politely. She learned how to wrap books against dampness, how to oil the lock and the front door before the freeze came, how to read enough of a shipping notice to know whether a man asking for a harbor sketch truly needed it or merely wished to impress her with words he thought a shop girl would not understand. She understood more than most of them guessed. In quiet hours, she read whatever passed through her hands. Not many novels, those felt extravagant and faintly suspect. She preferred atlases, almanacs, sermons, histories of exploration, handbooks on weather, and old bound journals of lake traffic. She liked practical writing and language with purpose in it. Still, when no one was there, she sometimes opened poetry, reading it slowly, recognizing that something in the careful arrangements of ornately flowing words expressed feelings that could not be spoken plainly. By 18, she had become the sort of young woman people described with approval: capable, respectable, reserved. Not beautiful in a way that caused talk, but pleasing, with clear gray eyes, dark hair she wore pinned back simply, in a manner that made disorder seem faintly ashamed of itself. She smiled when required, laughed when genuinely moved, and kept most of her own inward life to herself. She had suitors, or what passed for them, in a town that understood courtship more as a gradual convergence of circumstance than as romance. A clerk from the grain office walked her home 3 times one summer and then stopped. a widower with two children sent over a basket of apples with intentions that were so obvious she could almost hear them creaking beneath the fruit. A cooper's son, earnest, clean-handed, and kind, asked if he might call, and did so twice before realizing her silences were not shyness, but refusal. Rebecca did not reject marriage in principle. She simply could not bring herself to imagine spending her life beside someone who felt chosen only because he was available. Then one October afternoon, Elias Harker came into the shop for updated charts. He was 28 then, broad-shouldered, sun-darkened, and carrying the weather with him as if it had settled into the grain of his skin. He was not yet a captain, but a first mate who already moved with the assurance of a man used to command when command was necessary. His coat smelled faintly of cool air, wet wool, and lake water dried into fabric. His hands, when he removed his gloves, were rough enough to catch slightly against the paper as he unfolded the old chart he had brought for comparison. He did not attempt charm. Rebecca noticed that first. Most men speaking to a young woman behind a counter adjusted their voices unconsciously, turning jocular or soft or overly careful. Elias simply told her what he needed, the latest soundings, corrections near the Northeastern Passage, confirmation that the harbor markings had been revised since spring. He spoke to her as though he assumed confidence, and because she possessed it, she answered without hesitation. He watched her once or twice with a look she could not then interpret. Not admiration exactly, more like attention sharpened by surprise. When she brought out the updated charts and laid them open side by side on the counter, he bent over them and asked, "You know these waters?" "On paper," she said. It was a plain answer, but something in it pleased him. "Better than some men know them afloat," he replied. She might have smiled then. Later, she could not remember. Only that he returned the next week on a pretext flimsy enough that even he seemed aware of it. He needed a tide table he likely already owned. After that, he came in for a barometer fitting, then a packet of log sheets, then a mariner's handbook no one with his experience truly required. By December, the lake season had shut down in earnest. Ice and hard weather drove vessels into layup, and men accustomed to movement found themselves stranded ashore with winter pressing them back into ordinary rooms and ordinary time. In town, one could always tell who belonged to the lake by how poorly they carried stillness. Elias, Rebecca discovered, carried it no better than most. He began timing his visits nearer to closing. Not so near as to be improper, but near enough that conversation could continue while she straightened books, and he leaned one shoulder against the far end of the counter, hat in hand, asking about whatever lay nearest. Whether she read the adventure stories some men bought and never finished, whether she had always lived in town, whether she thought maps made the world seem smaller or larger. She answered more than she expected to, perhaps because he did not pry. When she chose not to elaborate, he did not fill the silence with guesses. He seemed a man who respected what was withheld. There was relief in that. Outside, winter deepened. The streets hardened into rutted channels of snow and dirty ice. Window glass filmed with frost at the edges. Sleigh runners hissed past in the evenings. Rebecca's rooms were so cold at night that she could sometimes see her own breath before sleep, but she said nothing of it. One said nothing of such things unless there was reason to believe that they could change them. One evening, just after Christmas, Elias asked if he might walk her home. She considered refusing, from habit rather than reluctance, because she knew by then that his company left her less tired than solitude did. So she nodded. The streets were quiet. Light from shop windows stretched yellow across the snow, then ended abruptly in blue shadow. Their breath rose white before them. For several blocks they walked slowly, speaking only of weather, shipping, and the damage that ice could inflict on ships if layup preparations had not been properly done. Then, as if continuing a conversation already underway in his own mind, Elias said, "I know people who talk plenty and say nothing. You are not one of them." Rebecca looked straight ahead. "Nor are you." "No," he said after a moment, "I suppose I'm not." It was not necessarily a declaration, yet something in the air altered after that. By mid-January, he was calling formally on Sunday afternoons. Nothing theatrical, nothing grand. He would arrive in a clean coat, sit in the widow's small parlor where Rebecca rented her rooms, and speak with a seriousness that made the minutes feel sturdier than ordinary time. Sometimes they discussed books, sometimes the lakes, sometimes almost nothing. Rebecca mended, poured tea, or simply listened while he described ports, weather, cargoes, near misses and fog, or the strange sounds of rigging under sail. He did not romanticize the work. That too, she noticed. Elias spoke of the lakes as one might speak of a powerful animal, admired, understood in parts, never trusted. One Sunday, while wind rattled the window frame, she asked, "Why do you go back to it?" He seemed to consider the question honestly. "Because it is what I know best," he said. "Because it's honest. It will kill you if given the chance, but it doesn't pretend otherwise." Rebecca folded a piece of cloth in her lap. "And is that enough?" "For me, perhaps." He looked at her then, and in that look she understood that he knew it might not be enough for anyone wading ashore. He courted her through the layup season with the same unsentimental persistence he brought to everything else. No poetry copied into notes, no extravagant vows, but there were small, exact kindnesses she trusted more. A book left aside because he heard her mention wanting to read it. A better coal scuttle appearing by her door after he noticed the handle on hers was splitting. An umbrella repaired and returned without comment. An orange at midwinter, rare enough to feel almost luxurious, set on the shop counter with the awkward gravity of a gift that mattered. By March, people had begun to speak of them as if the question were settled. Rebecca, who had spent years thinking of herself as someone to whom things happened, rather than someone who chose, found the idea both frightening and quietly right. Elias was 10 years older. He had already lived a full man's life by the measure of labor and danger. He knew storms, command, injury, debt, and responsibility of the kind that required decisions hard and fast. She, by contrast, had lived mostly among ledgers, shelves, threadbare hymns, and the discipline of making herself useful. Yet there was between them a kind of mutual recognition she had never expected to find. He saw that she was not fragile, and she saw that he was lonelier than he appeared. When he asked her to marry him, it happened without ceremony, as so much that mattered between them did. They had walked down toward the harbor in the first uncertain weather of spring. Ice still clung in gray panes near the pilings, and the lake beyond them looked like beaten lead. Elias stood beside her, hat in his hands, his gaze on the water. "If you marry me," he said, "it won't be an easy life." Rebecca almost laughed, not from mockery, but surprise. Easy had never been offered to her as a condition of anything. "I know," she said. "I'll be away often." "I know that too." He turned toward her then, searching for signs of sentiment in her face he mistrusted. He saw none. "I haven't much gift for saying things prettily." "That is not a fault." Something like relief moved through him. He drew breath once, slowly and deep. He took her hands in his, squeezed lightly. "Then marry me." Rebecca did not hesitate. She said yes. They married in late spring after the thaw had fully broken and the harbor was beginning to wake. He was still a first mate then, with captaincy clearly coming. She was 18, nearly 19, wearing a dress altered with skillful economy, gloves a little too large in the fingers. There were no grand family assemblies, no full pews of relatives, nor inherited silver laid out afterward in celebration. But there were friends enough, witnesses enough, and sunlight that fell warmly across the church floorboards as if blessing could arrive by ordinary means. They rented a modest house that first year, then bought the larger one on the bluff the following year when Elias's prospects improved and command became certain. The house was larger than anything Rebecca had imagined as her own, though never grand. Its best feature was the view, which she did not love at first. The lake from that height seemed too immense, too near, and too unreachable all at once. Elias, by contrast, stood at the windows as though proximity alone were a kind of solace. Marriage proved neither idyllic nor hard in the ways young girls are warned. It was simply a life made up of absences and returns, routines and interruptions, tenderness expressed more often through action than speech. Rebecca learned the rhythms of shipping seasons, the preparations before departure, the peculiar, charged quiet of a home awaiting arrival. Elias was never demonstrative in the common way, yet he noticed everything. A hinge beginning to sag, an expense she had concealed to spare him worry, the way fatigue settled into her shoulders after difficult weeks. He repaired what he could, bore what he could not, and expected neither weakness nor performance of her. James was born when Rebecca was 20. Motherhood altered her more deeply than marriage had. The child seemed at once fragile and absolute, a small, breathing claim upon the world that made all prior fears rearrange themselves. Elias held the boy awkwardly at first, as though strength itself might endanger so slight a creature. But Rebecca saw from the beginning how completely he was taken. He would stand over the cradle in silence, studying the child's face with the same serious attention he gave to charts and weather, as if memorizing a route through some new dangerous waters. For a time, they were happy in a quiet way. James grew, Elias rose. Money improved enough that caution no longer governed every purchase. Rebecca left Willett's shop, though she sometimes missed its orderly shelves and the sense of being useful in a world beyond her own home. She kept books in the house, however, and charts rolled and tied neatly, some current, some obsolete, but too beautiful in their own way to discard. She read to James when storms kept him indoors, taught him letters at the kitchen table. When sighting conditions were clear, she wrapped them in blankets and stood with them at the window to watch for the approach of his father's vessel. Yet the lake never became merely background. It inserted itself into everything, into meals shaped by departure schedules, into conversations cut short because weather mattered more, into Rebecca's sleep on nights when wind came hard off the water and she lay awake listening for sounds no human ear could possibly detect from that distance. She accepted this as wives did, but acceptance was not the same as peace. When the accident came, it did not merely injure Elias. It altered the whole architecture of their life. He came back to her changed not only in body, but in relation to the world. The man who had once moved with unconscious certainty now calculated every gesture. The house itself became a lesson in limitation. Rebecca learned new forms of labor, lifting, cleaning wounds, adjusting bedding, keeping pain medicines in order, reading his face before he could force it blank. James, still young enough to be frightened and old enough to hide it badly, moved through those months with careful obedience, eager to help, and suddenly ashamed of his own healthy body. Rebecca held the center because there was no one else to do it. She did not think of herself as brave. Bravery suggested drama, There was little drama in the daily work of keeping someone alive and dignified. There was only repetition, patience, and the refusal to look away. When the braces arrived, she wept because she understood at once what they were asking of him. Not healing, submission. Yet she mastered even that season beside him, stood close while he learned to rise in them, slept lightly in case he needed help at night, changed the house inch by inch so that necessity looked almost intentional. If he saw what it cost her, he said little. But sometimes, very late, when pain or frustration had stripped him down to exhausted honesty, he would take her hand and hold it against his chest, as if reminding himself that something warm and living still answered when he reached for it. When he returned to the lakes 6 months later, Rebecca let him go, because love is not possession, because she knew he would diminish ashore in ways no care could prevent. By then, she was already ill. It had begun quietly a few months before Elias's accident, a fatigue she blamed on strain, a cough. There were days when her strength seemed to drain away without cause. She concealed it first from habit, then by intention. Now that Elias had only just regained a precarious version of himself, and James was still a boy in too many ways, she could not bear to place her own failing body at the center of the house. A husband and son stood helpless around it, so she kept going. By the time the illness had taken a deep hold, James was no longer living at home. He had been sent away to a boarding school 2 years earlier when Elias had returned to the lakes. It was a decision Elias had made with practical seriousness. The boy was bright and restless, and the town offered little that might stretch him beyond the narrow orbit of docks, warehouses, and the slow ambitions of local trade. Rebecca had supported the decision outwardly, though the house had felt suddenly hollow after the train carried him east that first autumn. He returned only at intervals after that, major holidays when the school closed its doors, a short visit in summer when the lake was at its brightest and most deceptive. A few hurried weeks when mother and son attempted to compress an entire year of ordinary life into borrowed time. Rebecca treasured those visits quietly. She listened to his stories of studies, teachers, and boys from cities he could scarcely imagine before. She noticed how his voice had begun to deepen, how his shoulders had lengthened, how he had moved now with the uneasy grace of someone growing into a life that no longer fully belonged to childhood. She did not tell him she was ill. By the time the doctor finally spoke plainly and she understood the full measure of her condition, Rebecca resolved with the same calm certainty that had carried her through every other hardship of her life. James must not be called home. He had only just begun building something beyond the narrow geography of the lakes. She would not draw him back into worry, nor allow his studies to become another sacrifice laid quietly upon the family's long ledger of necessary losses. Elias must not know. He had returned to the lakes after learning to walk in the braces, reclaiming what fragments of himself the water had not taken. Rebecca saw how precarious that return was, how much strength it required for him simply to stand again upon a moving deck among men who remembered him differently. To burden him now with a fainting wife waiting ashore would only reopen wounds that had only begun to scar. So she told no one who might betray her. Not Elias, not James. Only two close friends were trusted with the truth. Women who had known her long enough to understand that persuasion would accomplish nothing once she had chosen her course. She made them promise, firmly, that neither husband nor son would be told. They protested at first, but Rebecca's voice carried a quiet authority they had rarely before heard. "He has only just regained the lakes," she said of Elias, "and James has only just found a world larger than this one. I will not take those things from them." In the end, they swore to keep her secret. The illness, therefore, passed largely unseen. Rebecca continued the routine of the house for as long as she was able. She set her meals, kept the accounts, wrote letters in her neat, steady hand. She rested in the afternoon hours when neighbors were least likely to call and fatigue pressed more heavily. She learned to move slowly without appearing weak, to pause in doorways where the effort might be mistaken for thought. James visited during the seasonal harvest holiday, his father still away. He found his mother thinner, perhaps, though he might not have said so aloud. Rebecca laughed more than usual during those days, as though determined to send him back carrying nothing but warmth. She asked about his lessons, his teachers, the friends he had made. She listened carefully, storing each detail the way one might store provisions against the coming winter. During the visit, he asked her permission to forego his upcoming Christmastime visit, as he intended to accompany a school friend to his home in the Catskill Mountains of southeastern New York. She could not, in good conscience, dampen his obvious excitement at such a wondrous opportunity. When he left again, she stood in the doorway and watched until he vanished from sight down the road. It was the last time she would see him. The illness advanced more quickly after that. Over the next few weeks, the effort of ordinary tasks exhausted her. The doctor came more often, though discreetly, entering by the side door and leaving with the careful neutrality that physicians wore when there was nothing more to be done. Rebecca continued to refuse any message sent to Elias's vessel. The lake season was winding down, and all available ships had full manifest, factories and merchants placing orders they hoped to receive before winter's hand sealed its grip and late passage impossible. She knew that when word reached him, he would abandon his command mid-voyage, returning to find nothing he could change. She would not have that. Instead, she moved quietly through the house in those final weeks, as though memorizing its rooms, the kitchen window where morning light pooled across the table, the worn step on the staircase where James had once tripped as a boy. Elias's coat hung near the door, still faintly carrying the smell of cold wind and lake water. Sometimes she sat in the chair by the window overlooking the distant gray expanse of the lake. She did not stare at it as Elias did. Her gaze rested somewhere nearer on the fields and rooftops below the bluff, on the narrow roads that carried people away and sometimes brought them home again. Her friends came when they could, helping quietly with tasks Rebecca could no longer manage alone. They never spoke of the promise they had made, the promise kept. Rebecca's last thoughts, had they been spoken, might not have been grand enough for anyone else's liking. She did not think in majestic proclamations. More likely, she thought of whether James was current in his studies, whether Elias would be told gently, whether the blue cup had been left too near the stove's edge where it might crack, whether the house would feel unbearably empty once her step no longer crossed its floors. Rebecca was 37 when she died, alone. Elias was away on the lakes. James, just 17, away at school. Afterward, news traveled quickly. A telegram reached Elias's vessel when it docked 2 days later. A message was sent to James' school requesting that he be permitted immediate leave. Both arrived a few days hence. When James stepped back into the house, it suddenly felt smaller and emptier than the one he remembered from childhood. He moved through the rooms with the uncertain quiet of someone visiting a place that no longer belonged to him. Conversations with his father were awkward, no longer guided by his mother's gentle persuasion. James had not, until this absence, realized the importance of that persuasion. Within days, he returned to school. It was the last time he spoke to Elias, the last time he and his father's eyes met. For Elias, the experience of this return was like that of his son. The house that had always brought comfort and warmth was now empty and cold. Rebecca had been the warmth in those rooms, an abutment against the cold, the hand at the shoulder, the soothing voice during long off-season hours. She was the harbor light that did not boast of its own necessity, intelligence that needed no display. For an all too brief span between storms, he had come ashore and found Rebecca there. In finding her, Elias found the nearest thing to safe harbor he would ever know. Elias missed her. He needed her. And he loved Rebecca with a depth that he did not fully recognize until she was gone. Only now, it was too late.